Can I please have your full name?
Alan George Cross.
And you're just known as Alan?
That's correct, yes.
And when did you first come to Dursingham?
I was born in the village in 1933.
Right. And does anybody else in your family live in the village?
I have a daughter who also lives in the village, yes.
So presumably you go back a long way, your roots?
Well, my lifetime they do, anyway.
So, to start with, would you like to tell me all your memories about when you were a little boy?
All of them? Well, that might take a little time. I think my area in the village was around the common and the heathland. And as youngsters, we spent a great deal of time there. We spent a lot of the time was involved with catching rabbits and this kind of thing. At the time also, there was a dump on the village dump was on the what is now the closed common, and we used to spend quite a lot of time scavenging around the dump in order to find anything that we could make a go-kart from, and we would make this out of all kind of materials, and would then use these things to go down the hills on the common.
Right, where we used to go tobogganing, presumably.
That as well, yes. This was long before the days, before there was as much bracken and heather on the common as had happened in recent years, and thus sledging and the like, as we used to call it anyway, could be done more readily on the common than it can today.
And of course you didn't have the traffic, did you? So if you wanted to pull your carts around the roads?
This was quite so. There was very little traffic on the road. In fact, it was a Sunday occupation, with many people would go to the common where there were probably six or eight seats on the common, and most of these would be occupied on a Sunday, and to watch what traffic there was coming along was quite an event in those times.
Some wealthy people had come.
Some did, yes. Many of them would break down, though. There was a breakdown was always an interesting point.
Because there was a garage in the village.
There were two or three garages in the village at the time, yes.
I mean, what were the normal breakdowns?
Well, overheating, I think, was a common fault then. Cars clearly hadn't got the sophistication they have now, and this was a frequent problem. And of course, punches was another frequent thing, because tyres were used until they were totally bare.
Really?
Yes.
So you used to play on the common and make your carts?
Yes.
And did you do any little jobs at all?
We had errands to do as youngsters. We nearly all had to do errands. My elder brothers had done the errands for one lady in the village, and this was a chore that got handed down through the family depending on how old they were. So my chore also was on Saturdays in particular to collect the groceries and such like, mainly from Parker's stores and Playford's Bakers and so on. But I got the sack one day after going to the shop with my half a crown in the purse, jumping the dykes as we went along Manor Road, and by the time I got the shop, the purse and the half a crown had disappeared. And hunt as I might, I didn't ever find that. And when I went back and reported it to the lady, she said, "Well, you perhaps you leave it, and you try to do my errands again when you're a bit older."
And so did they used to give you pocket money for doing these errands? Well,
that was a threepence worth of wages for doing that. Yeah.
And presumably you would spend it on sweets?
Invariably. One has to remember, though, that in my young days, this was the early days of the war, and sweets were just not available. It was a rare occurrence for the local grocers to have sweets, and consequently, naturally, we would spend it on sweets if they were available. But many, many times or many weeks would go by and there were no shit sweets in the shop to buy.
So, I mean, today, you know, children, they're always on about junk food and so on, but what would you consider a treat when you were a little boy?
I remember one instance when my mother had promised me something, if this was obviously during the war years, early war years, if I did so and so and so and so, and I did these things, and I was given an orange, and that was a treat to her. That was the best she could get at that time to give me.
Yes. So during the wartime, what sort of diet did a young lad have? Can you remember?
In many ways, perhaps in the country, we may have benefited by some of the townsfolk, in as much that nearly everyone had allotments. We all had big gardens, and that was part of the thing that we had to do to help on the allotments and the gardens to grow various things, which meant that we had a good stock of vegetables and this kind of thing. Many places also kept chickens, and which obviously gave you some food from the eggs, and indeed when the chickens got old, from the chickens themselves. We used to have sport by catching rabbits, although at the time we didn't really appreciate it. As youngsters, we had our enjoyment from trying to catch these rabbits, but they were in fact a basic diet, and from this point of view, in some ways, we food wise we perhaps didn't do too badly, but vegetables and what you produce yourselves was one of the main things.
So it sounded really as if it was a very healthy diet.
It probably was. In terms of what we have today, it was a healthy diet. Everything was natural that you had. There was very little tinned stuff at that time. Obviously, that was early days of tin foods, and two, they simply weren't available.
And milk, of course.
Milk was plentiful. There was never a problem with milk. Local delivery people, or indeed the farmers themselves, were had their own milk runs then.
And of course, children did a lot of walking, didn't they? I mean, as well as your playing and out with your carts, you walked everywhere, didn't you?
We did have to walk everywhere. I mean, I lived at the end of the drift in the village, and I went to the local school, which was the only school, obviously, at that time. Of course, that was walking to school, which must have been a mile plus, I would think. Back home at lunchtime, back again after lunch, and then home again in the evening. And this was common enough for so many children then.
Yes, yes. So you went to the school.
Yes.
Was the secondary school here then?
The secondary school was built just before the war, but it did not open until after the war. It was used by troops and so on, or the military purposes during the war, and didn't open until after the war. The year when the new school, as we then called it, obviously St. George's School, opened, that opened after Easter. I left school at Easter, there being in the last group to leave at 14.
So you missed out on
school totally, yes.
But did you have friends who went there?
Oh yeah, well, anyone who was slightly older than me would have automatically gone to that school, yes. Then, whereupon they had another year to do, because the school leaving age was raised to 15.
And did any of them ever tell you what it was like compared to your primary school?
You tend to lose contact with people once they go to school, bearing in mind, as soon as I left school, I started working, and as agriculture was the main thing in this area at the time, I started working, and you do tend to lose contact with people who are still going to school. I suppose our main contact then was the varying sports that we tried to play, and there is where you would get your contacts again.
Yes. Now, you say you helped out, but what, your parents had always lived in the village, had they?
My parents had lived in the village. My father was in the First World War. My mother and father got married soon after the war, the First World War. And my mother's family had certainly lived next to the Heath. The Heath house was their family home. And my father had lived in the village, well, I don't really know, but certainly a long, ever since the First World War anyway.
And what did he do in the village for a living?
He was involved with working at Sandringham Estate for most of his lifetime after the war, as of course so many people were in the village at that time.
So when did, because you now are a builder.
Yes.
Did you start being a builder from when you left school?
No, I didn't. I didn't start in being a builder when I first left school. When I first left school, as I just said, agriculture was a prime thing, and I was involved with land work and worked on a farm that was, most of which was beyond the railway line, the railway crossing by the station. And I started there from 14 and continued there until 1953 when the floods came, and I had been deferred from the services up until that time, as was a common thing with people who worked on the land. And when the floods came, 90% or more of the farm that I'd been involved with was simply inundated with water as the sea came right up to the railway crossing. Thus my reasons for deferment disappeared, as the farm couldn't be used at all because of the amount of salt that had got into the land. And as a result of this, I then was, National Service was still going at that time, but so I went into the Air Force. I actually went in for 3 years instead of actually doing a National Service.
And so it was when you came back to the village?
It was after I came out of the Air Force that I got involved with building work, and I virtually remained doing that ever since.
Now, you say you spent your childhood mostly during the wartime.
Yes.
What can you remember about the effects of the war on this village?
I suppose the schooling probably was, although you, as children, you don't realise it at the time. It's only looking back that you realise how things are affected. I think probably the schooling made a great deal of difference, because the schooling was quite poor at the time. One has to remember that many of the younger teachers had been called up, and sport was completely out as far as the school was concerned. So I think in many ways it was they were very poor years as far as schooling was concerned.
Were they having just temporary teachers, you mean?
Some were temporary teachers. Some were very good teachers, though. I remember in particular Miss Boyce and Miss Robinson. Miss Boyce became Miss Cook, I beg your pardon, Miss Cook was her original name. She married and became Mrs. Boyce, and later became Mrs. Barker. She was a very good teacher, and she was strict but respected. And Miss Robinson was also a very good teacher. She took the children in earlier years. She was very good, also respected. I think the further you got along in school, the poorer became the teachers, or at least that's how we found it. And respect went for the teachers to some extent, and learning wasn't emphasised enough.
Do you think you had lost a lot of the men teachers, which were mainly replaced by women teachers?
That's right, that tended to be the case.
And that's why there wasn't the sport anymore, probably.
I think, well, the sport wasn't allowed. We weren't allowed to go onto the pastures to play sport at all. I suppose to some extent this may have been because of the possibility of air raids and this kind of thing, because there had been trenches dug in the school gardens and on the emblems, which were where, if there was an air raid, had to evacuate too.
So in school you had to be prepared at any time for a raid?
We had to be prepared. We had to take our gas masks everywhere we went. We carried our little boxes with a gas mask in it. Yeah, that was standard practice then.
Would you say, looking back, that you were frightened? Or didn't it bother you?
Well, we weren't bothered at all. To some extent, as children, I mean, we didn't realise what others in other places were going through, but to us, the military activity that was going on around here, because there were troops, thousands of troops manoeuvring around here from time to time, and to us that was wonderful entertainment to be out and associate ourselves with them as best we could.
So I suppose all the little boys wanted to go in the army themselves.
Well, some of them did, but we again around the common area where the troops used to use for manoeuvres a lot. If we could find a few thunder flashes that hadn't gone off when they'd been using, that was our pride and joy then.
So you really were quite dangerous finding one.
Well. I suppose you were, but we didn't see it that way at all at the time.
No, just typical boys. So really you weren't that, apart from the cutbacks, as you say, you weren't really affected by the war.
Well, everyone was affected by the war, but of course you have to appreciate at that age you hadn't really known anything different, so you didn't realise what you may have been missing.
Yes, yes. So probably the biggest thing for you was the flood, because of the effect that had on your livelihood.
The flood probably it changed my line of life that, again, you didn't realise at the time. I went into the Air Force, as I said, for 3 years. After we'd done our initial training, we went on a coronation route lining in 1953. We then went and did our trade training, and after I'd completed that in November, I went to Singapore. I spent about roughly two years in Singapore, and we were then posted up to Butterworth, which is just opposite Penang Island, and I was actually on leave on Penang Island when I was called home on compassionate leave. My father had been taken ill, and I was granted compassionate leave. I came home on compassionate leave for about a month, I think, and I subsequently got compassionate posting, and I was posted to West Raynham, where I completed my service until 1956.
Right. Now, going back to the floods, had there been warnings before that this situation could have happened? I mean, had there been very high water before? Can you remember?
There had been a series of floods of a much lesser degree at Snettisham. Snettisham had always been the vulnerable place, and there were floods there in 1947, I believe, and there had been one or two floods there before, but I don't think anyone had visualised anything on this kind of scale. Snettisham had been allowed to build properties which people were living in permanently all along the seafront, and it was these folk who suffered the most in this particular area. On the day of the floods, or the night of the floods, 31st of January and the 1st of February, that night, the bungalows, some bungalows at least, were literally lifted and washed right across the shore until they virtually landed on land again near the railway line, and it was then that they simply broke up. And obviously people who may have been in them had no chance whatsoever.
So they were drowned. So is that why there is no longer people allowed to actually live along there?
I think that was one of the main reasons why that happened. But since then, of course, there has been a substantial secondary bank put in all the way along the coastline now, so that the tide would have to rise considerably more than it did then to actually breach that bank. There is a double banking there now, but at the same time, as you just said, people are still not allowed to live in the huts beyond the seaside of that banking.
Now, when they talk about the greenhouse effect and the effect it's having on the seas with the melting of the ice caps and so on, they talk in the future of parts of Norfolk actually ending up underwater. Do you think this could happen here now, or do you think we're too well protected?
Well, in for many years now, the reverse has been happening, and the wash is silting up from our corner anyway. And I must have been about 20 years or so ago now, where another large land of area was reclaimed at Wolferton and Wootton, when a new bank was created to check the sea, and several hundred acres of land was incorporated back to or into agriculture.
Right.
I don't think this would apply to our particular area.
Yes, so it would be much further around where this kind of thing would happen. Right. Now, as your job as builder, you must have seen enormous changes in this village from the point of view of building work.
There has been a huge increase in properties built in various, what one would consider, green areas of the village, obviously mainly since the war, which is obviously the time that I can remember most. The population must by now have at least doubled, and the current development that's going on, when from the start to when that finishes, will probably increase the population in this village by about 25%, and this is starting to turn what was village life into a small town status now.
And do you think that's a shame, or does it not worry you?
I think it is a shame, but I think this is a process that will continue to go on. Although most of the land, private land now, has been taken up, or will have been taken up by the time this development takes place, I think if the pressure is there for more land, it will be released by Sangamo Estate, and they will not have any problem in getting permission to build if they so decide.
So you're saying that some of the Sandringham land could eventually go, because everybody seems to think that we have more or less come to the end in this village of building because there is no other land.
If there's sufficient need there for development, I think Sandringham, they want money just as much as anyone else, and they would release land. You've got to remember now, we're almost hemmed in by Sandringham land, and if the need there is there for more building land in this village, I think they will release it piece by piece.
Now, which bits of the village that Sandringham owned would you say would be the most likely to be built on in the future?
Well, there's a small field just near, as we know, at Parker's Corner. On the Sandringham side there, there's about 6 acres there. I think that could well come in. You have quite a large area at Dodds Hill on the left as you go up Dodds Hill, stretching round, in, if necessary, as far as the Carpet Corner. And back there.
You're talking about land behind the existing houses that go up Dodds Hill?
Yes.
That field behind there, that's Sandringham land?
That's all Sandringham land, yes.
Right.
Sandringham land right through to Sherman Road.
And then there's the field just past the church.
Yes, that is also you can see how the village could well expand in these particular areas. Yes.
Now, what about the allotments?
Which allotments are you referring
to? The ones down Station Road.
I think it'll be a long, long while before building take, provided there is still a need for people still wanting the allotments. I think it will be a long, long while before ever building takes place on there. In any case, it would need the sanction of the charity commissioners to change the use of that land in the first instance. They would be very reluctant to do that if there is any need at all for people wanting allotment land.
Now, as a builder, you must have seen a lot of changes in the way houses are built and properties are built. Would you say that properties in the village are being sympathetically built or not?
For the most part, but when you get developments such as the current one going on, I mean, there is about 4 or 5 different designs which just are repeated and scattered about at different places in the same site. I think that's a great shame. You lose the individual situation where you had many individuals, whether they be private people or builders, having the choice to build what they wanted to build. You've got a lot of variety. The market generally dictated whether those properties were multiplied or not, but where you get these large developments, you as I just said, you perhaps get 5 or 6 different designs, and you've got 360 odd houses that are going to all be designed within that scope. Mountbatten Road, for instance, was sold off for in individual plots to many different people, either the private purchaser or small builders who maybe built two or three for themselves. As a result, you've got quite a good variety of different properties, different shapes, different designs, different brick colours and things like this, and I think that kind of development, now it's had the opportunity to mature, is far better than the current large building site which is going on.
Right, and can you think of any more, are there any infill places now left in the village, or have they all more or less disappeared now?
Most of them of any consequence have gone. There are odd plots from place to place, but anything of any size has gone. The restriction has been not to allow one village to merge with another, but there is still land going towards Inglesthorpe that could be built on, but so far that restrictions have always, or the planners have never allowed that to happen. I think in many cases the planners are at fault with the lack of variety in properties, because they don't allow individuals to do what they want to do. Many things are done because the planner thinks it's better to do that, and in my view, many times the planner's view is no better than an individual's view of what kind of property they would like to have put up. Building to certain regulations, there's nothing wrong with that. That is a good thing, but in many cases it's just a planner's opinion against a private individual's opinion.
Yes. Now, further along on the left, going towards Inglesthorpe, is of course the wood, which tends to make a natural barrier at, yes, the end of the village. Who owns that?
Some of that wood is owned by Mrs. Bell, who lives the opposite side of the road. As far as I'm aware, that was part of her father's estate. I don't know how the tie-up is, but I think there's certainly an involvement with that family.
But that could never be built on, presumably.
All attempts, some of it has already been built on, one has to remember. When you talk about Woodside Close, that was actually driven into what at one time was part of Lifelane Wood.
Ah.
But having reached the point where it has now,
yes,
the planners have resisted any further development of that site.
Because it would be a pity to lose that natural
indeed,
bit of greenland.
Indeed, yes.
And then, of course, the other side, the meadow where they have dogs and horses,
yes,
and things, presumably that also belongs to the owner of the wood.
That belongs to that same family,
yes,
as far as I'm aware, yes.
And that could be built on.
It could be built on, yes, yes.
So we still have quite a lot of future building.
That could be the case, yes.
Because certainly most of the people I've interviewed feel very strongly that the village is now too big.
Yes.
And to make it any bigger would be dreadful.
This is true. I mean, I'm not advocating the spreading of the building, but pressures dictate that, don't they?
Yes.
If there's enough pressure for it, it tends to happen. I'm not advocating the village being any bigger, but I can't see the trend stopping. If the need is there for properties.
Yes, yes. And then, of course, you do get the advantages that you get your own supermarket, your own library, and so on.
Well, I think with the supermarket, I mean, there's certainly a lot of local resistance to that when it was in the planning stage. But whatever one attempts to do today, there's always going to be someone agin it, as they put it in these,
yes,
terms. Having the supermarket having established itself, I think it serves the village well. It has to be said, because many people in the village use it, so it's certainly serving the village far better than the dun cow that used to stand on that site, does.
If you could think of one thing that could improve the village from an amenity point of view, what would you say?
That one's difficult.
Some people have said a swimming pool. It seems when we've got the sea nearby, it could be useful to have a swimming pool.
Well, I think one's got to remember that we are a village, and when you have to consider not the introduction of these big projects so much as maintaining them once you've got them.
Yes.
And this I think is where the problem would arise, is keeping it maintained over a good number of years. And in this sense I don't think the village is big enough for a swimming pool. I think where you've got Hunstanton and King's Lynn, which are comparatively in easy reach, I think that is a place where those kind of projects should be, and not in the villages.
On the other hand, a bank would be very useful.
The bank has been sadly missed. We understand the bank closing its sub branches in villages like Dursingham over the years from their own economics. But if you could add up the time and trouble that it puts local people to get to the bank in King's Lynn or Hunstanton, it would far out, the cost of that would far outweigh what the bank are saving. But of course it is the bank's money that they are saving, so they don't mind too much about that.
Now, did you belong to any of the clubs or organisations in the village?
I currently belong to the British Legion and the Ancient Order of Foresters. I've been involved with the Ancient Order of Foresters, which is a friendly society for I suppose since I was in my 20s, something like that anyway. And we've been involved with the running of the local court, as they call it, since that time.
Is it a very old...
It's the organisation started way back in the 1800s. Our particular court was started in 1842. We had a Foresters Hall built, which is still in the village now. It's not now used as a meeting place for the foresters because of the decline and the lack of interest in using the hall for such things and public events. It simply wasn't a viable thing, but it was built in 1893, I think, and it still belongs to the foresters. Court in the village, but there's now used as a carpet warehouse.
When you say court, does that mean, is that the name for group?
Court, branch, they tend to call them branches these days. Yes, that is similar, yes.
Now, when it was first started, in your youth, for example, in the village, it must have been quite an important club.
At one time, I mean, around the 1900s and certainly probably up to the Second World War, there was no such thing as the National Health Service, and these kind of clubs were the forerunners in many ways of the National Health Service. If you didn't belong to some such organisation, and there were others besides the foresters, and you fell upon bad times, you had nowhere to turn to whatsoever. So it was very important that the people did, at least the breadwinner, did belong to an organisation like the Foresters to insure against illness. And it still applies today, but to a much lesser degree.
So it was a kind of mixture of a union and a National Health Service club.
The unions, there was a difference between the two. The unions tended to be hostile to employers, or that the employers would treat the union as hostile, but that wasn't the case so much with the foresters, because if the members belonged to the foresters and they hit bad times, that the employers would consider that the foresters would be looking after them and the employer wouldn't have to. So the employers were quite happy to have the foresters involved, and such friendly societies, there are others besides, but they tended to be more hostile toward unions.
Now, when the foresters was first set up, where did the funds come from?
The funds come from the members. They're simply from contributions. It was a case of, in many instances, in our early days, the unit that was insured for would be a 10 shilling a week unit, and depending on the age of joining, as with so many insurance things, depending on the age of joining, it would depend on how much contribution you would make. And over the years, money has been built up surplus to what's actually been paid out, and in this way the organisation as a whole has become quite wealthy now. When I say as a whole, I'm talking nationally.
So our village still has this Order of Forestry.
Yes.
But it's just a very small arrangement now because people don't need the funds.
Our court at present has just under 100 members.
Oh.
And not necessarily all of them from the village, but there are just under 100 members.
And you don't have to pay in a vast amount of your salary now,
as you did then. If you want to join today, and people do still join, clearly it's all proportionate. Depending on how much money you would expect to need if you became sick, for instance, you would pay proportionately, depending again on your age, for that amount of contribution. There is a scale for the amount of money per age, for every £100 that you may want or whatever that you would pay in.
Now,
there are order insurance. There's another thing which really is a saving scheme in many respects.
Right. Did they used to do things in the village, you know, to raise funds when you were a young person?
Well, I was not involved too much myself, as I said, until I was in my 20s. But the court meetings were a thing that the membership were expected to go to and used to go in large numbers. This doesn't happen so much now. There's quite a small number of us who are involved with the running of it now. But at one time, yes, it was such an important thing. These kind of organisations were for the ordinary working folk of this area and other areas, obviously.
So you'd meet at the Foresters Hall?
Yes.
And did you have things like dances and so on?
Yes, we have organised ourselves since we've been involved with it. We've had dances and tombolas and things like that have been done. And at one time when they used to have the meetings, in fact we still have some of the old stuff from it now, we used to play dominoes and darts and things like that in the hall.
Yes.
The members used to use the hall. Well, that dropped off over the years.
I suppose the television didn't help.
That's right. We started using the hall for general letting. I mean, it's been used for all sorts of things. The Foresters Hall, it's been used as a church, a play school, a bingo hall, a cinema. All these things have been used for in the past, and many other just private functions, weddings and so on. But as I said, it simply wasn't paying. When probably went on until the school was turned into a community centre, whilst that was probably a very good thing as far as the school was concerned, and it was a decent community centre. But it tended to kill off the lettings that were available were spread too thinly for these private halls to survive.
Yes.
And we found that we were going to either have to sell the hall or something was going to have to happen, simply because it wasn't paying, and we would have been bankrupt just trying to maintain the hall.
Yes.
Because although you weren't getting much income in, you still got your maintenance costs and so on to keep going with.
Yes. What would you say was the worst time you can ever remember in the village? Was it the floods, do you think?
Well, I think to me it had to be the floods, because it affected us so much at the time. The morning after the floods, we went out in took a boat that had been washed up and went down the marshes looking for bodies, because there were many people missing still at the time. And I think probably that's the thing that's maybe changed my life and was the most significant thing as far as I was concerned anyway. There is, when one has to remember that when the floods came across the marshes, which was some 2 miles in a straight line, I suppose, everything in its path was brought to the shore, which then became roughly the line of the railway line in our area, which meant that corn stacks and hay stacks, and of which there were many spread across the area, were all brought to this float in this line, And of course many bodies of cattle, stock, rabbits, anything that was down there was simply drowned, and it was all among the debris. There's about 2 feet, I would think, of straw. And one particular thing I remember, because we were looking for these bodies, a heel of a water boat was sticking out above this float, and I remember gingerly picking it up, hoping that there was nobody in it, which fortunately, as far as I was concerned, there wasn't. But that was the kind of thing that was serious at the time.
And of course, it must have had a big effect on the running of the trains, which were, of course, so important in those days.
Well, it didn't affect the railway here too much. There were certain areas that were flooded and washed away, but the railway embankment, although it wasn't very high, the line itself was the gradient of that was above the marshland, and as a consequence, apart from where there were culverts where ditches and things went under the railway line, for the most part the railway line, raised although it may have only been a few feet, was enough to become the final barrier for the floods going beyond that.
So in fact it was a good thing it was there, or it could have come even further.
But the water had virtually peaked at that point.
Right, yes. What would you like to see happen in the village in the future?
Well, I think by and large for the village to remain roughly the size that it is now, I think in some ways the commons ought to be more done to the commons to bring them back into line like they used to be. Going back further, one of the significant things that I remember most, and coupled with the railways, every year when it was a dry year, there would be fires started by the steam engines, and it would just depend on how long it had been between fires as to how much of the fen and the common got burnt off.
If it had been a very dry spell,
yes.
I'd forgotten about that. The flames would come out and set the common alight.
Literally that, yes. I mean, the fen was the where the line, the railway line ran through the fen, and in dry years, certainly that would happen. And if you didn't get many fires in one year, it just meant that when you got a fire, that would be a bigger one. I can remember a fire starting right over at Wolferton, sweeping across the whole of the fen and onto the common, and it simply couldn't be stopped. But the fen was the better for it. Although these things got burnt off, and of course some wildlife unfortunately would perish in the fire, the land itself and the area itself would soon regenerate itself, and that got rid of all the rough and dead foliage that each year.
Whereas now, of course, unless it's set on fire deliberately or through children playing or something, it doesn't burn, does it?
Well, there's been a lot of problems recently with the lack of management of the fen and the common land, and it isn't really, there's been any lack of what has ever been done. The main difference is that the trains don't run any longer to set fire to every so often. This is the difference. But as a result, many, many places now that used to have a clear vision right through to Wolferton from anywhere on the common, because of the trees and things that have established themselves, because they've been left untouched for years and years, have become almost forestry now, rather than heathland, which is what we're now trying to restore to some of the common land. But as I say, the fires were the principal thing that managed the fen and the common land more than people. It's only in recent years, when the fires have disappeared, that the lack of management has taken place, So what would be little scrub trees and now become
big
large trees.
Now, the bit of common land at the end of Heath Road on the left.
Yes.
Now, is that one of the places where, as you say, you used to play?
Yes, yes. Any of the common land and the fens themselves.
Yes.
We used to roam all that area.
And now, really, as you say, it's become very overgrown. That
yes,
piece of
yes.
heath at the end there, and you don't see, when we go for a walk there, you see very few people on it.
Well, you may see very few people on it. One reason for that is probably because it's got grown up that much that people can be walking, possibly there can be more people on there than you see, simply because it's no longer an open area. At one time, when it was an open area, if someone was on the common anywhere from another point on the common, you could see them. And I have seen pictures of people scattered about all over the common, certainly in earlier times. And many villages, of course, it would be the afternoon's outing in the summertime. A lot of people would be on the common in the summer.
And there would be nice grass to sit upon and so on. Oh, yes, it's all scrub.
Principally heather. You see, heather is the thing that's gone missing. When birch trees, which after all are only big weeds and bracken are allowed to grow, they're one of the biggest enemies of heathland, and they choke everything else that's around there. So as a consequence, where there were large areas of heather, they've now become overgrown with bracken and birch, and as a consequence, the foliage that you'd like to be there has disappeared. Now, and of course, rabbits have also made a lot of difference. The lack of rabbits as a result of myxomatosis, which started in 1953 and has been going on and off since then.